in the open square of the city, for no man took them into their house to spend the night. And there was an old man coming in from work in the field in the evening, and he was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. And the old man invites the man, the Levite and his concubine, into the house, and they are there as his guests. But then, as they were relaxing in the house, behold, men of the city of Gibeah came, very base fellows, it says. They started beating on the door, and they said to the old man, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know who he is." And the master of the house went out and said to them, No, don't be so wicked. This is a man who's come into my house as my guest, and what you're suggesting is completely vile. Behold, here is my virgin daughter, and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Ravish them and do with them what seems good to you, but don't do anything to this man." But the men would not listen to him.
They cheated their women well.
The men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and put her out to them, and they ravaged her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break the next morning, they let the concubine go. And as morning appeared, she came and collapsed at the door of the old man's house where her master was until it was the morning. And the master rose up in the morning. He opened the doors, went out to go on his way, and behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house.
Surprise,
with
surprise.
Her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's go." No, I said, "Get up, let's be on our way." But there was no answer. Then he put her upon the ass, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and laying hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, "Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day." So he sends these 12 pieces around, and all of the tribes of Israel come up in arms, and they destroy the city of Benjamin, and kill all the women, all the men. They kill all the men, and then they have to get new men for them, and all. It's very, very complicated. This is Gibeah.
They destroy their own city, then.
Yes, they destroy an Israelite city. Yes. The other tribes gang up on the tribe of Benjamin and destroy that city. All right, so no external forces involved here at all. This is an internal feud within the Israelites. All right. We still have a bit of time here to make some progress, and we're going to try to make as much as we can.
Can you go through that story again? I like it.
You'd like to read it in this version. It's more graphic.
It's more graphic, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, when we move the book of Ruth, I don't want to spend much time on that. That is merely, I would say the book of Ruth is, to me, a realistic picture of relations between the Moabites and the Israelites during the period of the Judges. This is a story about a woman of Bethlehem who goes from there over to Moab. And I was in Shukri, this kind of thing happened in the 19th century very, very much. Isn't it true that most of the major cities of East Jordan have kind of a sister relationship to a city in Palestine? And Karak has a lot of Bethlehem and what's the city in southern Palestine? Hebron. Even the Majalis, for instance, all came over from here. And you have a lot up in Irbid and northern Jordan that come across. They have a kind of a constant back and forth relationship in the 19th century, especially. So this is realistic to say that a woman from Bethlehem during a time of famine would have gone across over to Moab, which would have been a natural area of retreat during such a thing. And she marries. Her daughter's married there, and the story goes on. It's rather a romantic story, but the picture is, I think, a fairly realistic one. Let's go on now to it, however, is realistic in what sense? It implies minimal antagonistic relations between the two regions, between the Israelites and the Moabites, at least in this context. In fact, it even implies in here, doesn't imply, it is the case that this puts David, isn't it correct? That yes, David then ultimately becomes in the lineage of Moab. He has Moabite blood in him. We're going to see that this may be a factor later, because when David later sends his family over to Moab for protection when he is being chased by Saul. So these groups are also somewhat mixed and had friendly relations with one another. Now, when we come to the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel 1 to 8, I'm sorry, I jumped a little bit. I want to, Judges 13, 1 to 2. Judges following. We have our Judges 13 and then 1 Samuel. We have the first appearance in earnest of the Philistines and of the sea peoples. It is in Judges 13 that we have the first real outbreak of Philistine challenge to Israel. The people of Israel again did what was evil, and the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. Then it goes on here into the great Samson cycle from Judges 13 roughly to the end of the book. And this Samson cycle is the Samson and Delilah, the crushing of the temples and all of this kind of stuff that takes place, the kind of competition that went on between the Israelites and the Philistines. Unfortunately, it just starts the way I read it, that is, sold them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There is no statement anywhere in the Bible, except in much later texts, that explains where these sea people, Philistines, came from. The word Philistine is certainly the same as our Peleset. Nobody disputes that. The Peleset of the Egyptian texts are the same as the Philistines of the Old Testament. The Egyptian texts describe the sea peoples, or Peleset and Cheker, coming down as we describe. The Israelites give no such description. They do not say, we were contentedly sitting in our land when all of a sudden this wave of intruders came and wiped out half of our country. It doesn't say that. We are going to see that it says that in obtuse ways, but it never outright says it, and it never says where they came from or how they were there. It just suddenly, poof, out of the blue, they are there. And they are there in a very major way. We're going to see that under Samson, the Israelites are definitely on the defensive. We have few references now to East Jordan. Almost all of the references during the coming pages are all towards these sea peoples. But I want to emphasize, this is where they come in. We had them once with the Ammonites here. That was our first definite reference. And now with Samson and Samuel and Saul, they become the big enemy. And the Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites become definitely secondary. Now, I'm not going to read the Samson part. I think everybody knows the part about Samson. But we want to go now to 1 Samuel, where we get Saul. Samuel, 1 Samuel 1 to 8. Shiloh was the main center of Israelite control at this time. It is Seilun in the northern part of the hill country of Palestine. Shiloh, Eli, was the priest at Shiloh, and he had two sons who sat with him. And there was a battle. I'm going to read just one battle now. While Eli was at Shiloh, there was a battle between the Israelites and the Philistines. While Eli was at Shiloh, the Lord appeared to him and to Samuel at Shiloh frequently. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. But Samuel at this time was still a small boy. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines, who had encamped at Ebenezer. Ebenezer, we don't know exactly where it is, but it's somewhere probably halfway between the coast and the hill country. And the Philistines encamped at Aphek, which we know, it's, again, about halfway. It's in the Shephelah between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. At Aphek, it's modern-day Ras El Ain, very close to the road to Tel Aviv. The Philistines drew up in a line against Israel. First of all, that's a very interesting tactic. It's the same way with Samson. Remember when David and Samson fight? How do they fight? The Israelites line up on this side of the valley, and the Israelites line up on this side, and then they send out two champions to fight. All right, the champion Samson, Goliath. It's the same with Goliath, though. We have the same kind of fighting, and David and Goliath also. This is a tactic which is new to the Near East and may have originated with the Sea People, this lining up of sides opposite each other to engage in battle or to send across the champion that fights. You remember in the Homeric epics, you have that frequently, the great Trojan War, you have the heroes coming out from each side to fight between the two camps. So it may be a Greek tradition to do this. The Philistines drew up in a line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who slew about 4,000 men on the field of battle. But when the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why is it that the Lord put us to rout today before the Philistines? Let's bring the ark from Shiloh." The ark was the symbol of unity for this 12-tribe league, and it moved from place to place, but it was now semi-permanently located in Shiloh, where Eli was the priest and where Samuel was likewise coming up under him. "Let's bring the ark from Shiloh, so that we may have our God among us, and he may save us from these enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought the ark of the covenant, and the two sons of Eli were with it. When the ark of the covenant came into the camp of the Israelites, all of Israel gave up a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of this shouting, they said, "What's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp mean?" And when they learned that the ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, and they said, "Ah, a god has come into the camp, for nothing like this had ever happened to them before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians, etc., etc." So the Philistines said, "We have to acquit ourselves like men and really fight this time," which is opposite of what was supposed to happen. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And they fled every man to his home, and there was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Again, the numbers are probably far inflated. But, and the ark of God was captured. This was the most devastating incident for Israel, because it was the symbol of unity, not only political but religious. The Philistines captured the ark. They then go on to describe what happens with great glee. The ark is taken down into the Philistine territory, and then it proceeds to cause all kinds of problems down there. The Philistine god falls down on his face, and they get warts and boils all over their bodies and everything, so they finally send the thing back up again. But it still shows what had happened. Suddenly, without any explanation, this kind of story shows us that this area is no longer Israelite. I gave you what I thought was some evidence before, that this area was Israelite. And now, without an explanation, that has changed. These are no longer Israelites down along the coast. These are Sea Peoples, Philistines. And they are stronger than the Israelites, and they have cornered the Israelites up into the hills and pushed them there. And in fact, that is what we can read in certain places where it literally says that they were pushed up into that area. Let me read one more small part here on this before we stop to document what I just said. Samuel, after Eli, after the ark was captured, Eli dies, and Samuel becomes the high priest of Israel. And Samuel fights against the Philistines just like Eli did, and he was more successful. It says, "The hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath." Both of these are down in the valley. So there is the claim here of a counterattack where these cities along the coast were recovered. And Israel rescued their territory from the hand of the Philistines. And there was also peace between Israel and the Amorites, which implies some Amorite or Canaanite population here. This is 1 Samuel 7, verse 14. All right. Samuel is a transitional figure. He is the last of the big judges. We'll continue next time with Saul, who is a semi-king and who takes on not only the Philistines, but other neighboring powers as well. Saul ushers us into semi-kingship, and then David into full kingship. We didn't quite finish, but we're close to the end. Next time we'll finish up with Saul and David. Wrap that up, and then we'll go to the archaeology, which illustrates this very complicated but interesting period. But we'll read this one in detail. This is called the Battle of Karkar. Karkar is located right here. This is roughly the Aleppo area here, Latakia area here. Karkar is in between, right about here. In the year, such and such a year, I left Nineveh. This is now Shalmaneser III talking. Shalmaneser III left Nineveh in northern Iraq, and I crossed the Tigris, and I approached the towns on the river Balikh. The river Balikh is in Syria, right over here. So he crossed over the Balikh. And all of the inhabitants became fearful of my great position and the splendor of my weapons, and I killed all their masters. And I entered all their towns, and I brought my gods and images into their palaces. I opened their treasury, inspected what he had hidden, and I carried away booty all the possessions of that city. Then I approached Kar Shalmaneser, which is an Assyrian outpost on the Euphrates. I approached Kar Shalmaneser. He founded it as one of his main military outposts. I crossed the Euphrates at its flood time on rafts of goatskins. And I received tributes from all the other people, all the people on the side of the Euphrates. And then it gives a long list here of the people. Then I departed. This is where we get now to the nitty-gritty of. I departed from the banks of the Euphrates, and I approached Aleppo. So he moved off now from plundering this area around the Euphrates and came over to Aleppo proper, which is the first main Aramean state that he would encounter. They, the inhabitants, were afraid to fight, and they seized my feet in submission. I received silver and gold as their tribute, and they offered sacrifices, and I offered sacrifices before their god, Adad of Aleppo. Then I left Aleppo and approached the town of Hamath, moving south from Aleppo to Hamath. I captured all the towns of that district and the royal residence. I removed from them booty and personal possessions, and set their palaces on fire. Then I departed and approached Karkar. Hamath is about here. Homs and Hamath. He came down from Aleppo to here, and now he goes up the Orontes to Karkar, which is on the Orontes farther up. I departed, and I approached Karkar. I destroyed, tore down, and burned Karkar, his royal residence. Now, the important part is here. What was allied against him at Karkar? At that battle, he had 1,200 chariots, 1,200 cavalrymen, and 20,000 foot soldiers from Damascus. All right? 1,200 chariots. Keep that in mind. 700 chariots, 700 cavalrymen, and 10,000 foot soldiers from Hamath. Then, 2,000 chariots, 10,000 foot soldiers from Ahab the Israelite. This is Ahab of Samaria. Ahab contributes more chariots than any other power, but fewer foot soldiers. So he had more chariots than any other number. Then 500 soldiers from a small place, 1,000 soldiers from another small place, and here we have, for the first time, the mention of the Ammonites. We have the Ammonites included in this coalition against the Assyrians. We have Baasha, son of Rehobi, from Ammon. Unfortunately, the number of soldiers and troops that Baasha sent from Ammon is broken. We don't have the number. But this is a mention of the Ammonites involved in a battle all the way up here. So we have in this account the Israelites and the Ammonites. No mention of the other states, but the text is fragmentary. It might be missing. It's possible that it's missing.
The fact that we have these various different people fighting together is only due to one thing, namely, it's a greater threat from outside, namely, from the Assyrians. So what happened at this battle, the Battle of Karkar? They rose up against me for this decisive battle, and I fought with them with the support of the mighty forces of Ashur, my great god, and the strong weapons of Nergal, my leader. Nergal is the god of war. And I inflicted a defeat upon them between the towns of Karkar and Gilzal. I slew 14,000 of their soldiers with the sword. I descended upon them like a rainstorm. I spread their corpses everywhere, filling the entire plain with their widely scattered soldiers. During the battle, I made their blood flow down like blood flow down through the entire district. The plain was just too small to let all of their souls go down into the nether world, and there was an enormous field was not enough to bury them. With their corpses, I made a bridge over the Orontes River. Even during the battle, I took from them their chariots and their horses that had been broken to the yoke. So this is Chalmanezer the Third confronting this Aramean, Israelite, Ammonite, and other coalition. It was one great effort to break Chalmanezer, and it failed. He defeated them, but he did not move on to then destroy all of these areas. After that defeat, most of these small kingdoms gave tribute without fighting beyond. But we're going to see now this comes again and again and again. We get the Assyrians coming in many, many times. All right, now we have another text from Shalmaneser III. This is called the Black Obelisk. It's not from the same date, but we want to read a little bit about this. In the 18th year of my rule, I crossed the Euphrates for the 16th time. All right, so it's rather typical. Shalmaneser moved many, many times. Hazael of Damascus put his trust upon his numerous army and called up his troops, making the mountain facing the Lebanon as his fortress. I fought him and I inflicted defeat upon him. At that time I received the tribute of the inhabitants of Tyre, Sidon, and Jehu, son of Omri. Jehu, Yao, Mar, Homri. Now, Omri, what's strange about that? Jehu, son of Omri. What's strange about that?
He's not the son of, he's the one who killed
Jehu them. Is the one who wiped out the whole family of Omri. So Jehu, or Omri, would turn over in his grave if he knew Jehu was being called this. But it doesn't mean literally the son of. It is from the land of Omri. And we're going to see again and again and again. Now, northern Israel is named Mount Homri, or the Beth Homri, the land of Omri, or the house of Omri, after the founder of Samaria. And any of the kings that followed were called that. Now we have a picture of Jehu giving his tribute to Shalmaneser on the Black Obelisk. It's quite a famous scene. I will first show you the general obelisk and then try to show you also the detail. This is the panel which shows the tribute being given by Jehu. This is Shalmaneser III here, two of his accompanying people, and then four Assyrians. I'll describe this now. I know you can't see it, but I'll just describe it, and then I'll pass it around. And then there are four Assyrian bodyguards. Then, following them, there are 13 Semitic-looking tribute bearers, carrying pots, jars, long things over their shoulder. These are all Israelite tribute bearers, and Jehu proper is kneeling on the ground and kissing the ground right in front of Shalmaneser III. Now, there's a larger picture of the kneeling part right
there.
Where is it?
The top there?
Yeah. Here. Right here. This is Shalmaneser III. This is Jehu. There's no question about this. This is all inscribed immediately underneath. So the figures are without question who it claims to be. This is Jehu. This is Shalmaneser III. And these are Assyrian bodyguards and supporters. All right, I'll pass that around. That's the picture now of Jehu giving his tribute. as is also recorded in this one text. All right, we want to continue on with Adad-nirari III, just to give you a taste, and then we'll go on to Tiglath-Pileser III, who is more important, really. Adad-nirari III also invaded Palestine, and this is the first time that we have Palestine named as a place to be attacked. And it does not mean what we think of as geographical Palestine. It means the Philistine territory, the old area of the Philistines, but it involves other areas nearby, since he has to pass through Syria, Lebanon, etc., to reach Palestine. All right, so Adad-nirari, the great king, king of the world, let me just find the most critical list of names here. I may submit to my feet the princes of the four rims of the earth, that is, the whole world. I had every major prince submit to me. I conquered every place, including now the following list, as far as the great sea of the rising sun, and from the banks of the Euphrates, the country of the Hittites, the Amoru country in its full extent. The Hittite country would be southern Turkey. The Amoru country is Syria, in its full extent. Tyre and Sidon, which is Phoenicia, but again, it's not named Phoenicia, it's the cities, Tyre and Sidon. Then, very important, Mount Homri is the land of Omri, northern Israel. Then, we have a very interesting statement, Edom. This is the first time we have Edom mentioned in an Assyrian text. Edom now also contributes. Then, Palashtu, the Palestine, which is the area of the Philistines proper. As far as the shore of the great sea to the setting sun, I made them submit to all my feet, imposing upon them tribute. I marched against Damascus, and I shut him up inside the city. He seized my feet, and he became a slave. That means he became a tribute-paying individual. I ordered another 5th year I sat down and I marched against Palashtu, Palestine. I crossed the Euphrates at its flood. I defeated Damascus, and then it's broken off as he was moving farther south. So Adad-nirari III mentions the Philistines, Edom, Omri, as well as Phoenicians, Arameans, and others that he took tribute from. Now Tiglath-Pileser III, he was the greatest of these early conquerors. He moved back and forth many times through the area of Syria, Palestine. Am I all right if I go 5 minutes? Anybody has to go? Okay, let's go a little bit here to try to get this done. His campaigns are about 734 BC, and it gives us many, many details. We're fortunate in that respect. All right, who does he take tribute from? Here is a list of tribute that Tiglath-Pileser receives. He receives it from Sanepu of Beit Amun. This is the first time we have the Ammonites mentioned as paying tribute in an Assyrian source. All right, Sanepu of Beit Amun. Beit Amun is the Ammonites. Sanepu pays tribute. Salamanu of Moab here also pays tribute. Metinti of Ashkelon. These names, by the way, are listed for you on that sheet. You can check them against the sheet of king names. These are listed at 734 or 733 BC. So, the Ammonites, Moabites, then we have Ashkelon paying tribute of the area of Palestine. Then, Jehoahaz of Judah. Judah pays tribute. Kaush Malaku of Edom. Kaush Malaku of Edom also pays tribute, and then a number of smaller states. Gaza, likewise, also pays, but we are not given details as to who pays how much. That's one of the first lists of tribute. Then here's another one. In another campaign, I took tribute from the king of Judah. Then I received tribute from Rezin of Damascus and from Menahem of Samaria. Menahem of Samaria also pays tribute to Tiglath Pileser, and Hiram of Tyre, Byblos, Carchemish, Hamath, Sam'al, all of these great cities of northern Syria also pay tribute to Tiglath-Pileser. I carried away booty, the town of Samaria only did I leave undestroyed. Matinti from Ashkelon also paid me tribute. The house of Beit Homri paid tribute. As to Hanno of Gaza, who fled from his army and went to Egypt, I conquered the town of Gaza. As for Menahem of Judea, I overwhelmed him like a snowstorm, so that he fled like a bird. You get a lot of similes in these kinds of things. Fled like a bird alone, and he bowed down to my feet, and I returned him to his place. But I took from him gold, silver, etc. I received from Beit Homri and all its inhabitants many possessions, and I took them to Assyria. They, the inhabitants of Samaria, overthrew their king Pekah, and I put Hoshea, this is not quite the same thing that the Bible says, but it's the same sort of thing, namely there are many kings following each other. I put the king Hoshea as king over them. I received 10 talents of gold and silver from them. All right, that's Tiglath-Pileser. Now Sargon II, who brings down Samaria totally. Sargon II and the fall of Samaria. What is the problem with Sargon II claiming to take Samaria? In the Bible it said that it was Shalmaneser V. All right, Shalmaneser V is just before Sargon. And most people have argued that Shalmaneser started this campaign and Sargon concluded it. But it is a conflict. One place it says it's Shalmaneser V. The other place says it is Sargon. Sargon II here claims to take Samaria. Conqueror of Samaria, this is an inscription where Sargon gives so much importance to the fact that he destroys Samaria that he gives it as one of his titles. I am Sargon, king of Assyria, the conqueror of Samirina of Samaria and the entire country of Beit Homri, the entire country of Israel. I despoiled Ashdod, Hanno of Gaza, Cyprus I even approached. All right? At the beginning of my rule, the town of Samaria I besieged and I conquered. I rebuilt it better than it was before, and I put people from other countries which I had conquered, and I placed them in Samaria and put an officer over them. These are different texts, now I'm reading different parts. I besieged and conquered Samaria. I led away as booty 27,000 inhabitants. I formed from among them a contingent of 50 chariots, and I made the remaining inhabitants take their low social positions. I put an officer of mine over them. I imposed tribute on them, and they continued then to serve me. Ashdod, I also attacked. I conquered and sacked the town of Shinuftu and Samaria and all of the Beit Homri land. There was a battle also at Karkar. Damascus and Samaria revolted against me, and I defeated them at Karkar. This is the second battle. Hama. Here's a statement regarding Hama. Yalbadi from Hama. Yalbadi from Hama. A commoner who had no claim to the throne. A damned Hittite. The word here is really a cursed Hittite. Schemed to become king of Hamath. And he induced the cities of Arvad, Samaria, Damascus, and Samaria to desert to me. And he made them collaborate and fitted out an army. And I called up my soldiers at Karkar, his favorite city, and I conquered it and I burned it. I deported all the survivors of Samaria, and I settled new people there. From all different countries, I put them in the city. We have here, now finally, who then gives him tribute? At the end of all this, the rulers of Pelishti, Palestine, the Philistines, Judah, Edom, Moab, and others, now give me tribute. I, Sargon II, am the great king who receives tribute from all these places. So these campaigns destroyed Samaria and reduced all of the other areas to a tribute-paying situation. But we're going to see that we have no evidence that Ammon, Moab, or Edom really resented this or did not pay their tribute in a rather loyal way. The people who do not give it loyally are the state of Samaria, which leads to its total destruction. Some of the states of the Arameans, which leads to the destruction of Hamath and some of the Phoenician places as well. But Ammon, Moab, and Edom pay their tribute without any reference to warfare after the Battle of Karkar, that first big battle when they joined the coalition against the Assyrians. Now these texts, while I labored over them quite a bit, are really vital. I mean, this is not some historian telling you what happened. This is the account of what happened at the time from the Assyrian side. And it is clear from this that the biblical picture, which only vaguely touches on the Assyrians right at the end when Samaria falls, is not the whole picture. Namely, the Assyrians throughout Iron II are the dominant, powerful force over all of the smaller politics that's taking place between Israel, Judah, Philistia, Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Okay, next time we're going to continue with the history of Iron 2, B, and C, and the Persian period. We're going to finish up all the history, hopefully, next time. Then that will leave us with two or three lectures for the archaeology of this Iron 2 period, which... I didn't finish Mesha. We have to do Mesha next time. The Mesha inscription. The locals are one of my favorites. We won't skip Mesha. We'll start with Mesha next time and then continue on through Iron 2.